There are words and phrases from stand-up comedians, from movies, from television that I am wont to adopt as my own and then refuse to quote, which the Talmud says is very unwise. So there was a movie, a David Mamet movie. I don't know if it was originally a play. Many of his films are, called The Heist. I don't know if you know this. I love heist movies, so it appealed to me directly. And Danny DeVito has a great line in that movie. They're discussing payment for the heist, I think, and he says, "Everybody needs money. That's why they call it money." So I almost put the YouTube video I found up on my Facebook page as I announced my sermon title, but immediately thereafter, he unleashes a raft of profanity, so I thought better of it. Likewise, there's a lovely show on HBO now, a short comedy called Silicon Valley, which is about a startup in the valley, its efforts to capitalize itself and to become a full-fledged company. And at one point, they're on the brink of some success, and the owner of their incubator is tempted to sell his home, no longer to be involved in the startup, but to sell and move away because he's received a great offer for the house. And one of the startup employees said, "But it's just money. It has no real value," to which the homeowner says, "It literally defines value," which from the study of economics is true. Money is not good or evil, and as I'll say more later, it is just a store of value. It's just paper that we use to signify something more important. I've got my mind on money and money on my mind, as a rapper would say, because I think of two things, Purim and the exaggerated payment that Haman offers to slaughter the Jews, to slaughter Mordecai at least. By one estimation, it was hundreds of tons of silver, more silver than probably existed in the known world or even exists today. And then on Monday, Tuesday, I do this twice, 2 days a month for 6 months. I'm right in the middle of it. There's a program at UTK Haslam at the business school called the Developing Leaders Series or the Emerging Leaders Series. So it's been great education for me, a lot of sort of best practices and paradigms to bring home to synagogue and other management. Mostly it's for for-profit companies, but there are a few nonprofit workers, mostly university employees there. So it did come up, the phenomenal wealth and likewise the phenomenal charity of the Haslams, you know, and what influence they have on our community and even on the business school itself. I don't imagine that as a rabbi I will ever become more than middle class, but it's interesting to contemplate wealth beyond need. Think of people who have such means that they don't need to worry about the price of milk. And this week's parasha every year brings the question of economics front and center in many ways. It illustrates what might be a Jewish, or at least an Israelite, a biblical era economic, how our ancestors might have conducted themselves. All economics is the study of resource allocation amid scarcity. How will we as an economy and as a political economy allocate our limited resources? And what are the values implicit in our systems of allocation? More so, we see that in government budgeting and taxation, right? Or synagogue budgeting and revenue collecting, are really emblematic of the values we hold. So we see in Kitsa what economists would call a lump sum tax, that every person is done the exact same amount. It's not a proportional tax. It's not a progressive tax. In fact, the lump sum tax is most typically regressive. Since it takes the same amount of wealth from every person, it proportionally decreases the wealth of the poorest the most, which is unusual when we think of our Bible and Torah as implements of social welfare. As I've said before, the arc of history is long, but it bends towards justice, and I find that our Torah is a small, timely effort to bend the arc of history, the arc of Near Eastern history and ancient life, toward justice. So what might be underneath the lump sum tax, the shekel collection of Kitisa, the economic imperative and impulse? Is it for fairness? Is it for equality? Is it for equity? Most economists will tell you that equity is a fool's errand and destroys economies, but equity is a good question. We also see in Exodus, Deuteronomy, and Leviticus other examples of the ways in which our ancestors constructed their economic life, constructed the life of the populace of the polis. So we're told that each firstling should be owed to God, which is somewhere between a lump sum tax and a proportional tax, a percent tax, assuming that larger families had larger flocks, wealthier people had larger flocks, so they would have more firstlings in a flock. We're also told in Deuteronomy about a first fruits tax. We see that as part of the Haggadah eventually. And that's something like a percentile tax as well. And then we have very unusual, I think, maybe they're designed to burst economic bubbles, I'm not sure, but they are problematic to most economists, the question of jubilees of properties and sabbaticals of debts and land, things that would seem to be counterproductive in an economy. If you have no capacity to plan for the future, to invest for the future, and no capacity to borrow, even at interest, it's very hard for people to gain and sustain wealth. What is our tradition saying about money, beyond the fact that everybody needs money, that's why they call it money, or in our case, silver, or in French, the case of French, also silver. We often name our store of value after its origin. So the French word for money is silver. So it says Elimelech of Lezhensk, who was Elimelech Weissblum, writing in the 18th century in Poland, the Noam Elimelech, one of the early Hasidic sages, money is fire. It's a great metaphor. Fire could destroy or annihilate, and like money, it can destroy or annihilate. It can also illuminate and warm, depending on how it's used. I've said this before, my Zadie was quite successful in business. He and his brothers had a machine tooling company that in the 60s and 70s did quite well, mostly through government contracts. But they never lived very high on the hog. Once they had a Cadillac. That was the fanciest thing I ever remember seeing at their house. And I asked my bubby after his death, why didn't you splash out more? And she said, Zadie had a thought, what am I going to do with two forks? He grew up poor in Poland. It was nice to have everything he needed, but felt no need to have more than that. That's the sense of our tradition, that we shouldn't be a tzaddik in a fur coat, says the Eastern European idiom. That one with wealth could start a fire, could build a fireplace that would warm many people, or with the same wealth, wear a fur coat that only protects oneself. Money is like fire, has diverse and manifold uses, and like the human being, as its view of humankind and ego, our tradition is not paradigmatically opposed to money. It certainly does not view money as the root of evil, but as I noted at the very beginning, money is just a store of value. Money is a proposition upon which we lay our interests and value and the value of exchanges and the value of trade. What we do with it matters. The Palestinian, or often called the Jerusalem Talmud, says that Rabbi Abba Bar Acha said at the moment of this parasha, when the people collect jewelry to make a molten calf in rejection of God's indivisibility and God's unknowability, Rabbi Abba Bar Acha notes, there's no understanding the character of this people. They're solicited for the golden calf, and they give. They're solicited to build the tabernacle, the sanctuary, and they give. Which is to say, I don't know how much I should say this aloud, one of a rabbi's goals, one of the leader of an organization's goals, is to help people direct their giving, direct the finances of an institution, direct the values of that institution as represented in its budget and elsewhere, towards the good. You can use your money for a lot of things. I'm tempted to quote Jason Chaffetz's recent line that you could buy health insurance or an iPod. Those are not equivalent goods or even in the same range of prices, but that was something he said in defense of the new healthcare policy, that choice is what matters in money, but some things are not so easy to choose. So there is an understanding by our tradition that money, as I noted, is not evil, but represents choice for us, can be a store of value, not just economic value, but our values. But there's something, I think, beyond. There's an intangible quality to economics, an intangible quality to that poll tax at the beginning of Tisa, the collection of the shekel, the silver coin. It's a heavy silver coin. They've made them recently. They're heavy silver, kind of lovely. That there's something beyond simple exchange, rudimentary exchange, that the marketplace and the free market and taxation and budgeting are lovely, actually, are something to be, if not embraced, at least accepted wholeheartedly. But as Adam Smith noted, there is something intangible. There is an invisible hand, and to Adam Smith it was profit motive, greed. But to our tradition, it's God, that God acts in the community as we make exchanges, as we give taxes, as we contribute to congregations, as the traditional blessing says, whether it's light for Havdalah and like Shabbat candles, whether it's wine for Kiddush, whether it's bread for the wayfarer and the stranger, that there is meaning and some subtle and imminent with an A, godly meaning in the work we do with our money. So the Hasidic teaching is that we don't give a complete coin, we give a half shekel. Why? To teach that no person is an entity unto him or herself, that only by joining with another person does one become a whole thing, does one become whole. That wealth, economic enterprise, entrepreneurship, trade, living in a market and a kiosk and a stall is lovely. Those are important values. There was a long-held tradition that rabbis should not be employed as rabbis. Don't listen to that part. But that they should have employment. And I think the understanding was that employment is teaching you something. But there is something intangible. The idea, the ideal or paradigm of atomistic capitalism is certainly not a Jewish one. That we are joined together in some shared enterprise. And whether you call that enterprise a polity or an economy or just a community, it's not a group of individuals, but something greater. So in addition to thinking about the Haslams and Haman, not to compare the two, and those quotes about money, just the value of wealth, I often think of Muhammad Yunus, who was the founder of Grameen Bank and won a Nobel Prize. I believe it was not a Nobel Prize in economics. It was the Nobel Peace Prize, because the Grameen Banks started in Bangladesh, and their goal was to create communal and village lending societies where there could be facilities set up in places where credit was unavailable, such that someone could buy a tractor or plant new land or buy a donkey. Small investments that make a transformative impact. He created, more or less, he was one of the creators of the ideas of microfinance. And the principle behind that is that money is nice, but the shared economy is much more valuable. The communitarian economy is much more powerful. So although I have a deep respect for John Locke, Adam Smith, the founders of liberal economics, and I mean that in the classical European sense, what we often call classical or libertarian economics nowadays, there is something beyond, that is not enough. Judaism would teach us that communitarianism is a more profound value, and that for me, those just exist in tension. I try to hold to both. I believe in the free market, I believe in the community. There is something ultimately mysterious when we hand money to another person in exchange for a good or service. As I noted before, money is just a pretty piece of paper. It doesn't have any intrinsic value. So this week we learn about the ketoret, the incense spices. As Rafe pointed out, among other things, cinnamon is a loan word from Akkadian and then into Hebrew and then into English. I think other spices, we get their names from Arabic tea. All these spices and herbs comes from China. The word comes from China, and you can see as it migrates through India and the Middle East and the Near East and into France, the words for tea are all very comparable. They're all short one-syllable words, te, chai, tea. So there are many explanations of the ketoret, the incense, why it was there. Maimonides offers the most logical and scientific and rigorous explanation, which was sanctuaries and temples stink. They're overwhelmed with the iron smell of blood and the perhaps sweeter smell of grilled meat, depending on your preference. And so they were just a perfume to cover up the stench. That's nice. That's probably true. But the Rabbeinu Bachya, another medieval commentator, if I am timing him correctly, said that this isn't enough. God forbid that the great principle and mystery of the ketoret should be reduced to just a mundane purpose. That's God. Another great word for God is mystery. And I think that's the essence of an economy, why it works. Adam Smith couldn't explain why it works. He had to create this term, the invisible hand. He couldn't point to why an economy functions and thrives. He couldn't point to why people wanted to trade and prosper. He just made up a term because he didn't have a better word for the mystery that exists between two people, that the social and economic intercourse. We don't use that word often enough, but as it implies intimacy. But there is an intimacy in exchange. And that mystery of the economy is a holy mystery too. We couldn't exist without it, just as we wouldn't exist without God in our tradition.